and also by Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers. Cotton Party has been providing friendly service for over 30 years in the heart of downtown Chico at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase. More information by calling Cotton Party at 893-4923. It's noon. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. The opinions voiced on the program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. I want to just thank a couple more underwriters. We appreciate all of you who support KZFR, and especially our underwriters who I hope you will support. I want to thank Farmstar Pizza, where the farmer is the star, using locally sourced products to support our community agriculture. Sunday Jazz Brunch returns to Farmstar with live music from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., along with breakfast pizzas and mimosas at 2359 Esplanade in Chico. Open every day for lunch and dinner. Details on Facebook and at farmstarpizza.com. Also want to thank Burchard Construction, providing custom remodels, new home, and commercial building from foundation to finish. Burchard Construction, where the homeowner's input matters. Construction, custom construction with beauty and function. Bids, consultations, and employment opportunities at 530-864-5427 and at Burchard, spelled B-I-R-C-H-A-R-D, BurchardConstruction.com. So my name is Chris, and I have in the studio with me an important voice of the present, of the future, and I am very happy to introduce to you Sally Borey. And she is... Well, let's start at the beginning. she was born in Oakland, but before her first birthday, her family moved to Senegal. Both of her parents are Senegalese, and she was raised there for the first 9 years of her childhood before returning to the States in 2011. She came to Chico State for her undergraduate degree and is majoring in political science and legal studies, minoring in international business, and getting her paralegal certificate. She works as an administrative director at the Community Legal Information Clinic on campus called CLIC, and which is the only legal clinic associated with an undergraduate institution in the county. She's also the current president of the Black Student Union at Chico State. After graduating, she plans to take a gap year to gain more work experience before applying to law school. Throughout her life, she's dealt with issues surrounding race, gender, and identity. While some of these moments have been challenging, she never gives up on herself. Her goal in life is to be adamant in pursuing justice for those who've been denied the right to equality and human dignity, and I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you for that intro.
Yeah, and I really appreciate you coming in today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, Sally, I wanted to start off by asking you a little bit about Senegal. Mm-hmm. You have the advantage of being bicultural, African and African American. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, since most of our listeners are probably not very aware of the history, geography, or economy of Senegal, especially like even in this post-colonial period, can you give us a quick, relevant glimpse into that the country of your family?
Yeah, definitely. Senegal is located on the west coast of Africa, so we're sort of like known as the nose of Africa, if you were to look at Africa as a face. and essentially, yeah, we're a very small country. We've had influences from around the world, so being an ex-French colony, we've had... we were colonized by the Arabs. We had Portuguese influence as well. So we're sort of a country that's recognizes all of the influences we get from around the world, but at the same time, we retain our own African culture. And that's something I'm very proud of. And yeah, the politics in Senegal is... it's iffy. I think that's the best way to describe it, just because... Again, being an ex-colony of France, politicians try to sort of have that Western image and try to adopt certain political structures that may not fit the country, but because it's idealized in the Western world and like in Europe, it's like we're gonna adopt it and we're gonna be like them, when in reality it's not helping society as it should. And the people know that, but the corruption runs so deep, it's really even hard to put blame on anyone. It's just sort of there, and a majority of the people just live like their day-to-day life. Some of them immigrate, like kind of my parents, they did. They immigrated to the States for, you know, a better opportunity, and they wanted their kids to have access to a good education system, or at least better than what's back home. So people just kind of live their day-to-day lives knowing that this corruption sort of exists and like not knowing how to move forward with it. And it's unfortunate, but that's the way it is back home. You know, but if we want to talk about the culture and just people in general, I mean, it's the most welcoming, most beautiful place in the world. It will always have a place in my heart. I love it so much.
Well, I wish I could experience it through, you know, through your eyes, or through even my eyes. Be so cool to be there. I think that's it's wonderful that you're here and that you bring that richness with you. So appreciate, you know, that you, any time we have with you, thank you.
Absolutely, I appreciate that. No, yeah, it really, you know, my earliest memories of my life are of Senegal. Even though I was born here, I don't remember much about the States until I came back. So to me, that's sort of like my first home. And nothing will ever replace that or take that away from me.
Yeah, it's a good grounding then.
Very good grounding.
Yeah. So in your life, you've chosen to go into international business, and you're becoming a paralegal, and you'll become a lawyer eventually. What future do you see for yourself as you pursue your education and experience? You know, you're already experiencing things at the Community Legal Information Center, which deals with real life legal situations. Tell us a little bit about your trajectory, your directions.
I think my interest in business came from my parents, because they were both business owners. My dad worked in the clothing business and my mom was in the beauty business. So they sort of influenced, I have that in sort of just, I saw the way they were impacting the community around them, just by employing people, providing services to people. And I really want to do that in my life. And the political side, honestly, just, it was just in me. You know, I like to debate, I like to fight, I want to be an advocate for people. So to sort of get that legal experience and try to see how I can merge the two together is what's my goal, and hopefully I'll be somewhere in the global arena, in an international law or international business, doing something for people. Just because I've seen a lot of, I don't want to use the word corruption again, because people have a very specific, like, picture of corruption. But essentially, it's more of, like, the lack of assistance that's out there. And people really don't talk about it. It's sort of like an out-of-sight, out-of-mind issue. And I just sort of want to be able to take on that fight. And I think the international community for me is like where to go, just because I'm like multicultural and I've seen and experienced what it's like to live in two different worlds, and like seeing how each dynamic is so different yet so similar. And like that's where I see myself as. But yeah, it's I don't know what it'll be, but it'll definitely be somewhere in the international field, definitely working with different countries and just trying to find a bridge to gap and like advance the idea of globalization, because I think that's how we're able to create a better future for everyone. You know, and it's so it's so interesting just seeing the dynamic and how different it is, like, compared to, like, just the U.S. and Senegal itself, like, just society, how it functions, the things that people value are so different. So if we're able to sort of create system that works for specific communities and not just try to copy what the others are doing, that would be, like, my goal, trying to find a way to create a system that works for the people and not just follow what others are doing, kind of a thing.
Yeah, I think, yeah, that cooperation and the fact that we have limited resources on this planet, mm-hmm. and, you know, we can't, you know, the whole power dynamic that's so corrupting.
So imbalanced.
Yeah, it is. It's out of, everything's out of balance. So, yeah, I see this ideal in you, and really hope it you know, you manifest.
Yeah, I don't know how I'm going to get there, but that's the goal, you know.
Yeah.
Just take it one day at a time.
Yeah, that's all you can ever do.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so as president of the Black Student Union, you probably heard a lot about what some of the challenges face students, and especially students of color in a primarily white institution like Chico State. Mm. Can you go into what you've been hearing or experiencing and what the Black Student Union has been involved in, and mm-hmm. what, you know, have they been able to achieve any successes? What's going on over there?
Yeah, based off of what I've been hearing and the student members that I talk to, you know, diversity isn't on campus. It doesn't really matter how much the school tries to promote diversity and equity on their, you know, pages and social medias, and they're, you know, trying to show that there's diversity on campus. Once students actually get on campus, you don't really see it. And it's not necessarily anyone's fault. That's just the way it is, unfortunately. You know, Black students make up 2% of the student body at Chico State, which is ridiculous.
Really low.
It's super low. So what the BSU tries to do is basically sort of create these spaces for students to just come and see fellow students who look like them, who share the same experiences and can have these certain conversations that we can't have with our white peers. Mm-hmm. So if we're having events, if we're having panel talks, or just like hanging out in the CCLC, which is the Cross-Cultural Leadership Center, that's where the BSU is housed at. So we do have a space on campus where students can just come and just, you know, be with each other, whether it's through hard times or we're celebrating anything. So we're trying to basically just create space, because it's not on there and the school isn't necessarily doing anything to create that sort of space. They're advertising it, they're taking pictures and posting it on their pages, but it's like, is that really promoting diversity and equity, or are you just using it to gain, I guess, attraction from other students, which is not bad if you're trying to get students to attend your school because you value diversity and equity. That's very much okay, but at what point do you help the students that are already on your campus? Like, what about them?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, and also, I do see the importance of recruitment, but, you know, how does anybody pay for college anymore? You know, I just see all the stuff about student debt, and it's horrifying.
It's horrible. I don't understand. Like, to say that education should be free is something that everyone should be able to understand, and it should be okay to say that. So I'm not sure why it always has to be political when we're discussing education and literally the advancements of youth. Like, these people are going to grow up and carry the country forward, so why can't we make it easier for them? Like, why does it have to be a debate? Why does it have to get political and bipartisan? Like, it shouldn't be this hard.
It's our future. Yeah, you all, you know, carry the hope for all of us.
Right.
Yeah. You're the future leaders.
It seems like no one cares.
Doesn't it? Yeah. You know, have another war. I wanted to ask you about race. There's a perception of race in America, which is different compared to other parts of the world, and such as Senegal. Can you speak about that?
Yeah. I remember coming, like, when I came back in 2011 and getting such a culture shock, because the first thing people noticed about me was my skin color. Mm-hmm. It was the fact that I was black. First thing. And I remember growing up in Senegal, yes, everyone around you is black, and we all recognize that, but it wasn't such a platform, and it wasn't something that people pointed out. It was just your skin color. Yes, you're black, but that's it. But when you come to the States, it's, you know, being black is such an important part of a person's identity, and the trauma that it carries is so intense. So when I would walk around and people would say, oh yeah, the black girl, you know, like pointing out my race, like so publicly. And I was like, oh, so is you, you have to acknowledge that I'm black before you can even have a conversation with me, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was just like shining a light on my skin color. And I was like, oh wow, like it's actually a real thing in the States, but back home, like we'll have colorism there, but essentially racism isn't as prominent and blatant as it is in America. But it was a really interesting culture shock. Like the first thing people notice is your skin color, where back home it's like, sure, you're black, okay, and
so what?
Yeah, so it was a really interesting thing to experience, and you know, now I'm used to it. It's okay if people point out that I'm black. I know I'm black. I'm black and proud. You know, but it was definitely an interesting thing to experience growing up.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I'm speaking with Sally Bori. She was born in Oakland, but grew up in her early years in Senegal. She's the president of the Black Student Union at Chico State, and she is going to be an attorney and international business star.
Oh, cross my fingers.
No, I know it. I'm on it. So you mentioned to me that topics like social justice and inequality will always be hot topics here in the United States. Why do you think that we're so stuck in this country? You have a little bit of the outsider perspective that I think is important.
Yeah, I think it's because it's a part of American history. Mm-hmm. You can't talk about America without talking about the genocide of Native Americans. You can't talk about America without talking about the enslavement of Africans. You really can't talk about America without the incarceration of Japanese Americans. Like, and it keeps going and going and going and going, because America is, the ledger is littered with social justice issues, like, nonstop. So I think there's a certain point where people just have to accept that and not be offended or get angry when people bring up topics like inequality and justice, because it is a part of American culture and American history. We can't separate from it. We can't ignore it. We can't not talk about it either. You know.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that people in this country think that they can just brush stuff under the rug. I mean, it's like you have to first acknowledge what has happened, and then work on, you know, how are we gonna fix ourselves?
Exactly,
you know? It's crazy.
How to move forward, and moving forward isn't saying it never happened. It's not moving forward isn't ignoring the issue at all. It's talking about it and figuring out ways to move forward with that trauma, and include accountability as well. A lot of the times we don't see that, so it's. It's just something that people will have to accept, that it's a part of American culture and society and history, and we cannot ignore it.
Yeah. It's true. And, you know, I hate to move on. We're moving too fast through really important topics, and I apologize for that.
It's okay.
You know, it's just how we do. I wanted to ask you how you think the community of Chico should be interacting with the university and the students. It always seems like a university is sort of siloed off from the rest of the community, and yet, I won't say all the interesting things or all the important people, but a lot of what's important is going on there. We're sort of isolated from one another, and so I was wondering, how do you think it would be this town could be better after you've lived here for how long have you lived here?
Oh man, technically 2 years.
2 years, because so you have a perspective.
Yeah, I came here in 2019, and then the pandemic hit, so I ended up moving back for the rest of my freshman year and sophomore year, and I finally returned to Chico during my junior year.
Right.
But based off what I've seen and so far what the BSU has done with the student body in the community, ways to bridge that gap is just finding creative events and programs for community members and students to do together, just because, again, students are on campus because they're here to learn. They might not necessarily like be thinking about ways to get more involved with the community that they're in, because they're just always focused on schoolwork.
Right.
And community members are, you know, a part of the community because they live here. Mm-hmm. Yes, the university does have some adds on benefits to Chico, but that's not necessarily their focus. So if the school is able to create, just build connections with community members and organizations and find ways to just bridge that gap, is the best thing. I don't know the answer to that. Like, I couldn't tell you, but the Victory and Unity event that we had earlier this year would be an example,
right?
Where yes, it was an event held on campus, but it was open to the community members to come and learn about, you know, what we had to say.
Yeah, and for listeners who may not be aware of that, you know, normally we, every year we celebrate Dr. King, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. For many years now, it's been at Trinity Methodist Church, and it's been around that weekend of his birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, everything shifted, and everybody's going, but what about Dr. King Day? And yet, it turned out to be the most vibrant, the most exciting thing that's happened around here for a really long time.
Oh, man.
And it brought together, you know, it's because it was moved into Black History Month, and it was really grounded in the university experience and students there. So anyway, I know you were one of the organizers. Can you talk about it a little?
Wow. Yes, I mean it. I didn't even know Chico celebrated MLK Day like that. It wasn't until Dominique reached out to me, and she's one of the committee members on the MLK Committee Unity Group. And when she reached out, you know, she came to one of her BSU meetings. She was like, hey, guys, this is something that Chico does every year, and I think that it's time that we sort of pass the baton to the sort of Black youth that's in Chico and see what you guys can do to sort of not, one, have the event at the university, but two, find a way to, like, bridge, like, literally what we're talking about, bridging that gap between us and the community, like, find some type of creative way to do it. And basically we just all worked together in coming up with the event. It took a lot of like correspondence and jumping through hoops, but we were able to get it done, and it's probably the most rewarding experience I've had throughout my whole experience in Chico. I mean, the speakers were amazing. I didn't even think the Black community was that big in Chico until that day. I hear it, and they say, yeah, we have, you know, these events, and people come, and we do marches and everything. But to actually witness it, it was so moving. Oh my God. I called my mom, and I literally was crying, like, as this the keynote speaker Hardy Brown was like getting his artifacts like packed up. I literally called my mom, and I was like, Mom, this is the best thing that's ever happened, and I was like crying. But it was beautiful, and it was amazing, and the fact that we were able to sort of share or echo MLK's message about unity was just such a blessing, and I hope we're able to, you know, recreate that again next year.
I hope so too.
Yeah,
and that was Dominique Soares, and I got to interview her. She's a powerhouse, so yeah,
absolutely.
I hope she'll be the one to push it forward,
because
you're moving on, right? You're going to, your school year is winding down.
Yep, and graduating this semester.
Yeah. So my last question to you would be about how will you remember Chico State and your time here, but also thoughts for KZFR listeners in regards to peace and justice issues that I think are important, or I think, that you think are important for your life and future?
Oh, man. I honestly, I will remember Chico with good memories. It was hard and challenging trying to adjust to the town, but I will say that I sort of pushed through all of that and actually focused on what I could accomplish with the time that I had here. And I think I'm able to do that, whether it's with BSU, with my job at Click. I can confidently say that I will leave Chico a little bit better, a little bit better. And I will leave here knowing that I'm also better, that I was able to do something for my community. Mm-hmm. You know, I can say that Chico is a little bit home, has a little pocket in my heart. But yeah, if I could leave listeners with anything, it would be, I guess, what can you do in your life that will sort of push forward with the advancement of peace and justice? What can you do in your life to help someone's life be a little bit better? How can you be an advocate? And it doesn't mean that you have to be a lawyer or you need to know a lot of politics and history, but like, what can you do in your day-to-day life that makes you an advocate for someone who can't advocate for themselves, someone who's faced injustice and doesn't know how to fight back, someone who's been stripped of their human dignity, like we mentioned in the beginning? Like, how can you make that person's life a little bit better? I guess that's what I would leave your listeners with.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I've been speaking with Sally Borey, and we really wish you well going forward into your life. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's keep that spirit going.
I'll try.
We do need you.
Oh, man. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you.
So I'm going to do some announcements, and I thank you. You know what? Let's let Bessie Smith sing. Now, this is not a song. This is not a song that it's called The Downhearted Blues, and the reason why I have it is because this was first recorded in 1923, so there is no copyright infringement, but it's 100 years ago. This incredible woman, she was, and also the song, I haven't seen other songs like this. It was written by two women artists in blues, Alberta Hunter and Lovie Austin. Anyway, Bessie Smith is considered the greatest jazz artist who ever lived. And if you haven't heard her, then I want you to now. Here we go.
I've got those down.
All right. So, again, that's Bessie Smith, and one of the world's greatest jazz singers, some people say, mother of the blues. And so, anyway, this is a Peace and Justice program. I am honored to have just had the great honor to interview Sully Borey, and I have another incredible guest coming up here in a second. I want to just do one quick announcement because I don't want to run out of time on this. There's two things happening tonight that are important. The North State Shelter Team is having a benefit. It's a masquerade ball, and it will be at 7 o'clock and run through the evening at the Chico Women's Club. And I think most of our listeners know the incredible work that the North State Shelter Team does. And so that's a masquerade ball at 7 p.m., Chico Women's Club, 592 East 3rd Street, and also a memorial for our dear friend Ed Pittman, who was a host here on KZFR. That will be at 6:30 tonight, also at the Eagles Hall, which is at the corner of 20th and Mulberry. So I just wanted to sneak those two in. I have on the line with me a man who's had an important life and a rich life. He's Dennis Fritz. He's the director of the Eisenhower Media Network. He's a retired Command Chief Master Sergeant in the United States Air Force. While he was on active duty, he served as the principal senior advisor to four-star commanders at two major commands, both in Pacific Air Forces and Space Command. He also advised the former chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, General Richard Myers. He's as well as being the principal advisor to commanders at two large Air Force flying wings in Japan and also at Andrews Air Force Base. Dennis Fritz has held several positions at the Pentagon, on the Air Force staff, and the Office of the Secretary of the Air Force's Legislative Affairs. After active duty retirement, he served in the office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy as a contracted staff member. He earned his BS in management from National Lewis University and an MS in public management from the University of Maryland School of Public Policy. The organization that he is with that I sometimes used to find veterans who have a point of view that tends toward analysis and peace thinking is this Eisenhower Media Network, and it is brings forward expert former military intelligence and civilian national security officials. It seeks to bond cross-partisan audiences and diverse media outlets and among the American people, who increasingly sense U.S. foreign policy today is not making them or the world safer, and that is the truth. Welcome, Dennis Fritz, to the Peace and Justice Show.
Well, Chris, if you can hear me okay, I'm so glad to be here, and I got to tell you, I am extremely impressed. You did all the intel. Speaking of intelligence, you have every piece of intel on me that you can possibly have.
Well,
that's my goodness,
it wasn't that hard to find. So, you know, I wanted to get right into it because as I wrote to you, I'm pretty freaked out about what's happening with our endless wars, and I'm worried about nuclear war, and this is something that just completely weighs on me. And our country really does have a reputation for being in endless wars, and one of the things that that some Quaker friends sent me yesterday, I just wanted to preface this. They say, they wrote to me, the U.S. is the world's largest consumer of Earth's resources, and our military is the greatest polluter. At a time of diminished resources of the Earth's raw materials, land, and water, we have to think about the planet's survival, and there has to be concerted effort for lasting peace. We have to confront our deeply entrenched beliefs about this country and our place in the world. We have to work cooperatively with other nations to protect and share the planet. And so shared security. We have to choose peaceful solutions to conflicts. And so I wanted to start by asking you first about after the Cold War. And when the Soviet Union broke apart, the United States was focused on the Middle East, especially after 9/11. And so I wanted to ask you, since we're coming up on March 20th, about the 20th anniversary of the war in Iraq and the fact that there's still 2,500 soldiers in Iraq and still with a U.S. commitment to remain there, and hopefully the end to the authorization for the use of military force pending. But how can you, as an expert on this pre-invasion policy planning documents, tell us about, you know, talk about what you think it's important for us to know, kind of looking back, that could help us to look forward also? Because, I mean, Lord knows, you know, Biden has even asked for more money for the military in this next budget. That's a lot. Sorry.
I was going to say that's a lot, and I was trying to write. Let me just, I tell you what.
You go ahead.
So everything you mentioned, let me just give you, from my perspective, also included, you know, in my bio as you were, you know, sounding off and reading that off, that, you know, I spent probably 12 to 15 years of my life in the Pentagon, you know, in and out of the Pentagon, studying our policies and so forth when it comes to national security.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go back first. Let's make our way up to Iraq and, well, first of all, Afghanistan. And then before that, you mentioned about the Soviet Union. But let me just give you my thoughts on that, because my first assignment in the Pentagon, you know, we were, you know, that was really our big rivalry, you know, the Soviet Union. And then we turned to China and so forth. But let me just give you a quick historical background for my experience.
Okay.
When we talk about the Soviet Union and the collapse of the Soviet Union, I had a fortune. Opportunity to go over when the wall came down. I was working in the Pentagon in an office called Legislative Affairs, which is Congressional Affairs, where you used to hear about those junkets, you know, and Washington Post talking about the junkets that members of Congress were going over. I went over to Europe with a CODEL, as we call it, a congressional delegation, when the wall first came down. That ended so-called the Cold War and the end of the Soviet Union, which then returned back to being Russia. That ended the Soviet Union, and of course, Gorbachev made the decision to end the Warsaw Pact. So, and oh, by the way, if you've been seeing in the news, and you know, folks have been talking about it, it's been released officially now. We had government officials, to include Baker at the time, who was the Secretary of State, told the Soviet Union that we would not expand NATO, and which we did, and we'll be continuing to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, in regards to the Cold War, we never ended the Cold War. We tried to belittle Russia so badly. You know, we are the only superpower. We won the Cold War. You know, I'm just going to talk candid and straight. We couldn't keep our mouths shut. We just wanted to belittle Russia so badly. Then you get a person that's very proudful of their country as well. And then here comes Putin. Well, we're proud of our country, too. You're not the only, you know, superpower in the world. And so we continued the so-called Cold War with our rhetoric against Russia. So let's make our way now, you know, to the Iraq War. But before the Iraq War, Afghanistan, when 9/11 happened. And at any time, please, I can get going on. You stop me, Chris, if you want to ask a question.
No, I'm sorry. Here. I'm sorry I gave you such a long, garbled question in the first place. But you're doing a good job. Thank you.
Yeah, but I want to, you know, bring it all up to speed. Remember everything that you said, because they were all good questions, good points that are dear to my heart. We have 9/11 to hit, and we're all very supportive of somehow, you know, we can't let this happen again. But I would tell you, in previous terrorist attacks against the United States, we didn't look at it as war. We looked at it as a law enforcement criminal activity, you know, by a gang. It was not a country. The Bush administration coming in to the Pentagon and you know, already had it out for Iraq, Iran, and Syria. You know, we were going to war over in Iraq regardless of 9/11. They were already, and that's my time from studying the policy planning within the Pentagon in policy. You know, we were already planning to invade Iraq. Unfortunately, 9/11 gave them the excuse to go into Iraq and start the endless wars. We use going into Afghanistan. First of all, think about this. The Taliban never attacked us. Afghanistan never attacked us. It was Al-Qaeda that attacked us. But because of the fact that Al-Qaeda and its leader, bin Laden, were in Afghanistan, it gave the Bush administration the opportunity, hey, we're going to start this so-called war on terror. Now, what did the war on terror do? And this, and you're talking about the AMF now, you know, authorization to use force, okay? Part of that, which a lot of people didn't realize, not only was it used to go into Afghanistan, but it gave the Bush administration to go into not only Iraq, but there was some fine print in there also that, hey, we could go in any country that we felt harbored terrorists. And so that gave them an excuse. That's why we hear Iran is the so-called, you know, the leading country of terrorism. Syria. Of course, we went into Iraq. All these wars are about not so-called us fighting terrorists. It's about imperialism for us in the Middle East, to include now, you know, with the war against Russia and the wars we're trying to start with China right now. You know, that's one of the things when I was in my expertise and background, I was the senior enlisted leader in Pacific Air Forces. And, of course, our two main areas then was North Korea and China. We've had an agreement with China, the One China policy, that, you know, China was the China, and then we'll peacefully try to work out between Taiwan and China, their differences peacefully. But all of a sudden here lately, and what I find so surprisingly, Chris, is that in the past, you know, that, and you've heard this term before, the neocons were embedded and ran, especially during the Iraq War, ran, you know, to the Republicans. Now I'm finding there are neocons embedded into the Democratic Party.
Right.
And a lot of people don't know that. And they're the ones that are pushing this battle. And we're going to get back to Iraq in a minute, but I want to get off this out because this is so current right now. They're the ones that's really pushing this battle. I find it ironically that you have some on the Republican side that, hey, we no blank check. We need to get out of there. But yet we have some on the Democratic side of the House, those neocons that people don't know about within the neocons, within the Democratic Party, are pushing this war with Ukraine, which, to be quite frank, if it's going to shock some of your audiences, that we really started in a way. It goes all the way back to our role in the coup of their president at the time in 2014, who wanted neutrality. Yeah. And so all these endless wars are based on neocons embedded into both the Republican Party primarily, but some in the Democratic Party, are pushing these never-ending wars for America's imperialism. Now, I'm going to take a deep breath and let you ask me some questions here, but let's go back to Iraq for a moment here.
Okay.
One key point to remember is that regardless, and this is factual, regardless of 9/11, we were going to find a way to go in to Iraq. And the reason, and then after that, we were going to go into Syria and then Iran later on. The reason Iraq was picked first, because after 9/11, a so-called case could be made to scare the American people so badly that they think another terrorist attack is going to happen, that that will give us our way and our justification, the so-called war on terror, with Saddam allegedly sponsoring terrorism. We're going to use this case of no of weapons of mass destruction, which now we all know never existed. Another thing I'll tell you, from my studying and within the policy arena when I was there, once again, even if there was no WMD, we were going in there. And you hear a lot of people say, hey, it was bad intelligence. They tried to blame the intelligence community. No, it was not bad intelligence. It was selective intelligence. They used intelligence that they thought could justify their case. You've heard the name back in the day, Shalabi. You know, he had it out for Saddam. So he had his group lying about weapons of mass destruction. And then you heard the term curveball, which a couple, and I won't use their names, because I'll reserve their confidentiality since they told me this in confidentiality. They were using curveball. That was a code name for an individual that, that said that he knew for a fact that Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. So they, and he was not a credible source. It was a source, he was in Germany, and the Germans told us he was not credible. But the Bush administration, the neocons, and particularly in the Pentagon, used it because it gave them a justification. So it wasn't bad intelligence. It was selective intelligence that took us in this war. And then one other point I want to make, too. Afghanistan was only a throughway to Iraq. We have this war on terror, and we were attacked, allegedly, it was planned in Afghanistan. Before we can go into Iraq, even that's our primary goal of going into Iraq and then Syria, we must go into Afghanistan first to make it look like we're fighting the war on terror, to go out and get Bin Laden. Now, I will tell your audience to go back and take a look at this. I think it was like 3 months after our invasion of Afghanistan, the planning for Iraq started. I remember I was on Andrews Air Force Base at the time and said, hey, you know, what's this about going in Iraq? What is that all about? Well, I will tell you, and this is the last point I will make for your audience, is to go back and take a look. Bush started saying, oh, Bin Laden, dead or alive. I think 3 or 4 months later, during a press conference, he was asked, well, where is Bin Laden? And well, I really don't think about Bin Laden no more. I don't know where he is. That was because of the fact Afghanistan was not our original target. It just gave us an excuse, along with 9/11, to go after the primary targets they wanted, which was Iraq, Syria, and Iran. Now, I will shut up on that. Yeah, that was a lot there. And that's where our continuous wars started and continue to this day.
And I'm always shocked by how radical some of you who are insiders are now after retirement. It's just amazing. But I'm on the phone now with Dennis Fritz. He's director of the Eisenhower Media Network. He's a retired commander chief, master sergeant in the United States Air Force. And Dennis Fritz, we won't have enough time for everything, so I want to focus two questions. First, about Ukraine, because Americans seem to be thinking that military victory over Russia is going to suffice for ending this war. And I don't see how, even with this huge outlay of weapons to Ukraine, that we are not going to be at serious risk of escalation. And I think not all of us peace activists, but a lot of us feel that this is a proxy war between the U.S. and Russia. What you said about NATO, I mean, that was certainly part of this. What are your thoughts about the path to diplomacy, the path to ending this war?
Great question, and I'm glad you asked that so we can get back to that. First of all, you are spot on, and this goes back when I said on our side, the Cold War never ended. This is absolutely a proxy war between the West, and in particular us, the United States, and Ukraine is caught in the middle. You remember when I mentioned about the president back in 2014, he wanted neutrality for his country in Ukraine, and we supported a coup that took him out, which brought Zelensky in. With that said, Chris, I was in the Air Force for 28 years. My whole life has been around the military. My dad retired from the Army. This is the most I've ever been concerned about nuclear war.
Yeah.
Now, let me share something with you. Mm. And here's why I say this. First of all, and most importantly, I don't care how much equipment we give Ukraine. Ukraine can never win this war. Why? Because of numbers. It's a war of attrition. As you notice right now, if Russia wanted to right now, if you take, like, I think it was this past couple of days, you had your largest bombardment of rocket strikes and missile strikes in Ukraine. Right now, Russia, without even using their ground forces, could destroy Ukraine. And so what I've been telling folks, the only way to end this is by diplomacy. Now, with that said, with that diplomacy, the only way Russia is going to end this with diplomacy is that Ukraine is not going to ever get back Crimea, because that is a strategic naval base for Russia to get to the black in and out of the Black Sea. So Ukraine is going to have to give up Crimea. Also, in that Donbass region you hear a lot about, eastern Ukraine, they're going to have to give up part of that too. Those are Russian speaking folks. You had rebels there, and that's where, you know, the war between Ukraine and Russia had been going on for some time anyhow, because of the fact of the Russian-speaking rebels that side mainly want to be a part of Russia versus Ukraine. So Ukraine is going to have to give up that eastern part of Ukraine, the Donbass region also. If they don't, then they won't have a country to have. Now, with that said, because it's a war of attrition, and when I said that I'm really probably the most concerned I've ever been about nuclear war, you know, part of my assignments, too, I don't know if you know, I was at one time, I was senior enlisted leader to General Myers, who during the war was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Before he became the vice chairman, then chairman, we were also out in Colorado Springs, where he was the commander. I was his advisor to NORAD, too. And so, you know, we follow everything up in the sky, you know, any nuclear alerts or all that good stuff. So I'm very familiar with that. And I never was concerned, but now I'm concerned. Why am I concerned? Is because of the fact that, as I stated, Ukraine can't win this war because it's a war of attrition. Russia would keep it on and on until there's no more Ukraine. Now, if we decide to escalate this and we put in troops, or there's an accident where it happened in the past, an errant missile hit Poland, and then we're decided we're going to escalate it. Well, here's what I will share with you. Russia is not going to lose this war. If they felt that they were going to lose this war, there's no question in my mind that they will introduce nuclear weapons. And once that happens, it's all over.
Yeah.
Russia is not going to lose this war.
Right. That's my fear, too. You know, Dennis Fritz, we're going to run out of time. I don't want to do that.
I know.
This is so important, and I hope our listeners are getting this fact, because what you're saying is fact. You know, I wanted you to also please address about China, because I know you're very much involved with that. I do not understand why we are pressing China. We had a one China policy. We're totally dependent on them for all of our consumer goods, it seems like. Can you talk about that tension and what the U.S. is trying to do there? I just don't get it.
Well, once again, Chris, we have to understand the mentality of folks that are in our government. And that is, that, like I said, it's embedded not only in our Republican Party, but our Democratic Party in some ways, too, of this imperialistic. You know, I don't believe, you know, in so-called, I love my country. I used to tell folks, I traveled around the world and couldn't wait to get back to my United States of America. I love America. Mm-hmm. But I don't believe in this America exceptionalism. You know, that we are better than everybody else. Everybody loves their country. But when it comes to China, China got too big for us. And what I mean by that, we made China what it is today. It goes all the way back to the Nixon administration. We brought them into the civilized world. Why? Big money, big business. Hey, you have all those resources there. And, oh, by the way, cheap labor. So that was good for America, you know, the Walmarts of the world, for the cheap labor. But then when we became just as dependent on China as they were on us bringing their businesses over there, they got too big a force. They went from an ally to cohorts to competitors. And we couldn't stand the competitor because they started getting the competitive edge. So then we went to an adversary. Now they're an adversary. Now we've made them an enemy. They don't want no war with us. The only thing that's a red line, from which I studied real hard, both in the Pentagon and when I was out in the Pacific, they feel that we should stay out of their business when it comes to China and Taiwan. And that will be the red line. And so to push them to the edge, we started slowly breaking away from our one China policy. It went to supporting a democratic so-called country to Biden saying aloud that we would defend them militarily. That was the first time, and I'd been associated with the Pacific since 1988. That was the first time I had been hearing that we were absolutely militarily defend them. Okay, that turned China off, because now you've taken away from that one China policy. You're actually dealing with Taiwan, and we don't like that because we think that's an internal issue. That worries me a little bit, too. And then you have the Spratly Islands, where there's some disputes out in some islands out there between Taiwan, China, Vietnam, other countries. And so, once again, Chris, unfortunately, we're the ones that are pushing this. China does not want war with us. Mm. And but like I said, they're becoming a competitor with us in this world. And those of us that believe in this American exception, that we should be the, you know, the only superpower in the world, we resent that China is now a competitor with us. And so now we're trying to make them into the bad guy, if you will.
Yeah. You know, Dennis Fritz, we are just about out of time here, and I didn't get to some of my questions. Can I invite you back on in the near future? Would that be okay?
I'll be more than happy to, and I promise you, because I feel guilty because I took up most of your time, but you hit some interesting points that I wanted to get out, and I apologize to you.
No, please, this is good. You know, so if we had a minute left, I know you're a big supporter on veterans issues, and yes. Can you just tell us a little bit about how you would have our listeners support veterans, because I think that, you know, a lot of veterans have gotten a raw deal.
Well, let me just say this real quickly in this 1 minute. Here's where I best sum it up, because we'll do this in another conversation. As we come up before this March the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War, here's what I'll tell you. Another part of my resume is that after I retired, I became an official wounded warrior advocate for the Air Force, and then I actually became the DOD contract program manager for the Wounded Warrior Program. And what I will tell folks is that on March the 20th, if you know of any veteran that served during Iraq and Afghanistan, just don't only thank them for their service. Thank them for their sacrifice, because they've lost limbs. They've lost their mind in cases with PTSD and then traumatic brain injuries from IEDs, improvised explosives. We need to thank them for their sacrifice, their long life sacrifice. And more importantly, listen to me on this. They went to war based on a lie and deceit. We need to apologize to them on behalf of our country if our country won't do that. That's what I will leave you with right now for those. But it was for all veterans. I know you're associated with Vietnam veterans who we left behind. And what I mean by left behind in health care. And that's why, you know, we have a lot of homelessness from our Vietnam veterans. We left them behind. We did learn that lesson, and we did come up with official sanctioned wounded warrior programs in DOD, which I was a part of, to take care of our veterans. And we are doing a better job of that. But more importantly, though, they have lifelong, the Iraqi veterans, they have a lifelong journey of injury and wounds. And we need to thank them, and we need to apologize on behalf of our government for sending them off the war on a lie.
Well, I agree, and thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate you. Stay well,
please. Well, thank you for having me, and I look forward to speaking with you again.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, so that was Dennis Fritz, and powerful speaker there. Yeah, too bad. I had more questions for him, but we'll get to it another time. All right, so stay tuned for Playing Dead. I just want to let you know that Chico is one of the places where the military dumps their used-up weapons. As soon as Afghanistan closed, they were dumping all over the country. So we have a policy that is the Chico Police Department's Military Equipment Use Policy 709. It's coming up for review. It'll be heard by the City Council on April 4th. The Chief of Police will be discussing this at the neighborhood church on Monday, March 20th at 1 p.m. How you're going to find out more about these weapons and ask your questions about why in the world we need military weapons in our community, you can find out more at cc4jchico.org. Please get involved. This is coming right up, and it has to do with every single one of us here who live in this community and don't want to be militarized. We are not a war zone. So I want to thank our underwriters. I want to thank BCAC.TV, Butte County's public access TV station, broadcasting on Comcast Channel 11. BCAC.TV provides arts, entertainment, and information programming, including daily broadcasts of Democracy Now! Weekdays at 11 and 5 p.m. Things are changing at Comcast Channel 11, and for more information or to get involved, visit BCAC.TV. And also the law firm of Peters, Habib, McKenna, Jewel Rhodes, and Cardoza LLP, Chico's civil litigation firm for personal injury, real estate, mobile home, and trust litigation. Their team of criminal defense attorneys has been protecting the rights of community members for over 100 years. The law firm of Peters, Habib, McKenna, Jewel Rhodes, and Cardoza LLP is located at 414 Salem Street in downtown Chico and can be reached at 530-342-3593. So stay tuned for Playing Dead. Please have peace in your hearts. Join us at the Peace Vigil tomorrow, 12:30 to 1:30, corner of 3rd and Main. And here is the community calendar. And peace. Here you almost go. Here we go.
It's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM community calendar with me, Mark Baker. Tonight, the North State Shelter Team presents the inaugural Masquerade Ball, a fundraiser to benefit Chico's Unhoused, from 7 to 11 p.m. at the Chico Women's Club. Live music, dancing, a silent auction, drinks, and fun. The Masquerade Ball will support North State Shelter Team in their ongoing effort to improve the lives of our housed and unhoused neighbors. The Chico Women's Club is located at 592 East 3rd Street in Chico. On Saturday will be a free food distribution from 2 to 4 p.m. at the South Chico Community Assistance Center.